And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
I've often said that one thing I learned when I was in the White House was to respect the people who came before me, who had been in those rooms when difficult decisions were being made, and who came there, whether they were Republicans or Democrats, with a deep commitment to our country and its future. Pete Wehner is one of those people. He served in three administrations, Reagan, Bush 1, and Bush 2. He also was a senior advisor to Mitt Romney in his campaign for president in 2012. But now, Pete has become one of the most ardent conservative critics of President Trump. I sat down to talk to him about how his journey led to this moment. Pete Wehner, welcome. Great to have you here. You've had an interesting journey, so I want you to tell me a little bit about how you came to politics, which I know you feel passionately about, how you came to your evangelical beliefs, and where you are right now in the era of Trump.
Terrific. Well, thanks for having me. I'm thrilled to be here, and I'm an admirer of your work.
Thank you.
So it's a delight to be here. Yeah, in terms of my own journey, both political and in terms of my faith journey and where I am now, I was a person who, as a young person in high school, was always interested in politics. I remember we had a cabin, which was about 2 hours outside of where I grew up, which is in Richland, Washington, east side of Washington
State. You're born
State.
In Texas, right?
Born in Texas, born in Dallas.
What'd your folks do?
My dad is a research scientist. My mom was a housewife, raised us. And so we moved in the later 60s to Richland from Dallas. And those were really my formative years mm-hmm. in Washington State. And then sort of in junior high and high school, you know, my favorite classes were social studies. I would get into debate. My professors were liberal. I was conservative. Not because
why?
I think it was instinctual, and I think it was my parents. My parents were Republican leaning and conservative leaning. Not
were they from Texas originally?
Actually, they both were from Germany. They immigrated. Both
oh,
both were
is
immigrants.
That right?
Yeah, yeah. Interestingly, my parents met. Mom's mother sponsored my father. She had met him in Germany. My dad's father was a dentist. He was a dentist as well. My dad. My mom's mother had a toothache. They met in Germany. She went back to New York where she lived, and he wanted to immigrate, and so she sponsored him. He immigrated in 1953, and my mom spent most of her youth growing up in New York. So I'm first generation.
Does this be I want to get back to the narrative.
Sure.
I'm the son of an immigrant as well. Does this color your feelings about this whole discussion that we're having right now on immigration?
That's a good question. I think it does. I think it does. I mean, I grew up with this idea of what America was through the eyes of immigrants, through parents. And there was a deep love for America, deep appreciation for America and the opportunities for America. And there was an attitude that Americans had toward immigrants that welcomed them. And we're in a different time now, and the Republican Party, the party that I've been a part of for most of my life, has a very different attitude toward immigrants now as well. So I think it probably is. We are the products of so many things in our lives, things that maybe we don't really aren't aware of until maybe we get older, but I think that was part of it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I can't help but think of this debate through the eyes of my dad, who's been gone for a very long time, but who came over here during the pogroms and, you know, was the kind of classic refugee and found freedom and opportunity and fought for the country and, you know, I love the country for being there for him and
yes.
so many others. And he in turn, and so many others helped build the country.
Yeah.
But these debates, Pete, that we've been having on immigration, you know, I think Doris Kearns pointed out to me, Doris Kearns Goodwin pointed out to me a speech that Henry Cabot Lodge had made in the 1890s, there was a virulently anti-immigration, anti-immigrant speech, and it very much divided. You know, there were certain countries that he felt were polluting our culture, talked about immigrants as stealing our jobs and lowering wages and so on. And if you just changed a few of the descriptives, it could be some of the debates that we're having today.
That's exactly right. I think it was Arthur Schlesinger Jr. who talked about the cycles of history. These things go in ebbs and flows. And there are bright moments and dark moments in the history of a country, including in this country. And you're quite right. The views on immigration the pendulum has swung very, very widely. And views, there was deep anti-Catholicism, you know, in the United States and prejudice toward Jews, toward all sorts of, of immigrants. And they were ugly then, and then the assimilation occurred, and now it's happening again with immigrants from a different set of countries, but often the impulse is the same. I think it derives in part by a fear of the other, which I think in American politics today there's just a lot of fear that is out there, and anxiety and uncertainty, and I think that fear and anxiety over time transmutes into anger and into rage and into attacks on the other. And it's unfortunate, but I think that's where we are right now. I don't think that will ultimately win, and it's not as if there aren't countervailing voices and forces, but in terms of over my lifetime, I haven't seen anything quite like this. You know, I'm a person of the Christian faith, and my faith is more important than my politics, and I try and interpret my politics through the faith. My own journey, I didn't actually grow up in a Christian home. My parents, you know, believed in God, but I don't have any memory really of going to church. I just remember in high school beginning to have these questions about faith. My best friend and I really at the same time began these questions. My oldest sister is 5 years older than I am. She'd gone off to college, University of Washington, and she came back in the summer. So this is in the later 70s. And I remember just peppering her with questions about theology. I remember my dad's notepad from work, and I would just ask.
Why her? Was she?
She was a person both that I admired. She had, as an individual, and also her intellect. She was just a very smart
person.
And
had she been studying theology? Or?
She had converted to the Christian faith while she had been at school, at college, and she came back. She actually was interning at a church. And so I just began to, you know, pepper her with questions. She then put me in touch with a person who I still am friends with. He's now a pastor in Richland. His name is Carl Kopic. But Carl, at that point, was, I don't know if he was interning at the church, but he started a Bible study with my best friend and me. So that began my journey of Christian faith. Though it was not an easy journey. Faith never came easily to me, and it was largely a cognitive process. Some people, it's a Damascus.
What was it that appealed to you about it? What drew you to it?
Well, my memory is that I wanted to try and ascertain the truth of it. There wasn't a kind of crisis particularly that I was going through, and I think I was too young, or in any event, I didn't feel an existential crisis about the meaning of life. But it was a struggle. I remember when I talked to my sister and I said, Patty, this is like sand in the gears for me. I think partly because what I read about from the Bible and what I had heard about what faith was supposed to bring to people, it wasn't bringing to me. To me, it was just, as I said, sand in the gears. I wasn't quite sure it was true. I didn't feel like if I came to believe that it would give me very much in terms of my own life and my heart and my affections and the reordering of my loves. Over time, it changed, and I became, you know, and I've been a person of the Christian faith since then, and it became a heart attachment, really more of the spirit than just the mind over time. And I've been so influenced by people that I've met in the journey. So over time, it became, you know, quite important to me, but I'm somebody who's very sympathetic to people who have struggles with faith and doubts, just because that was really so much my own journey.
So And there, these things have been intertwined in your life, your commitment to your faith and your commitment to politics. Tell me how that has worked. And I want to talk to you a little bit about how faith has been deployed in politics, because that's obviously a huge discussion now.
It really is, and I'm anxious to talk about it. I have some strong feelings about that, but just to take a half a step back, yeah, those two things have really kind of marched in concert, I guess, in my life. My interest in faith and my interest in politics, and both have been important to me, my professional and my personal life. The first piece that I ever wrote, I think that I ever had published, was a piece in the Tri-City Herald. It was a letter to the editor, and it was a warning. It was in response to a person. This was in 1980, shortly after Reagan had been elected. And it was a guy whose last name was Mays. I forgot his first name. And he had basically written, I think, a letter himself that conjoined the conservative agenda and Republican agenda and the Christian faith. And I wrote and I said, nah, that's dangerous and that's not right. That these things are distinct and they have to be treated as distinct. I believe that faith informs politics, and I believe people of faith should be involved in politics because I think politics is finally and fundamentally about justice. It's an imperfect profession for sure, and it's not the only means for justice. But I believe, as I think you do, and as I understood from your marvelous book, that politics is about advancing the human good, and that matters. And my faith has informed that, because it's one means to advance justice and human flourishing. At the same time, I've just always had this wariness about conflating them, both as a danger to politics and a danger to faith. If they get too closely aligned, I just think that it's destructive all the way around. And I feel like, in my case, the Christian faith should inform certain principles. But to take those general principles and to begin to precisely apply them to public policy is a very tricky business, because public policy, as you know so well, you know, governing is hard, and it's so often depends on prudential judgments and moments in time, and different moments require different things. So you can take, for example, a sentiment that I think is quite strong within the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament about care for the stranger and the dispossessed and the poor. But how that applies to a particular immigration policy or a particular welfare reform, that's not so obvious. And there you have to invoke good judgment, wisdom, empirical evidence, and so forth. But it's a tightrope. It's one I felt my entire life. I've seen up close, because most of my life has been involved in politics, what can happen to people of faith when they get too closely aligned with it. And I think the Trump era has underscored that more vividly and I think more problematically than at any other time in my lifetime.
Yeah, though, you know, we've seen various movements that have intertwined politics and faith. Some of them, I mean, you know, look, Dr. King invoked faith, it was central to his movement and the civil rights movement. You know, I look back at that and I honor it, because I agree with you that justice is at the core of it. But we've also seen we've seen, you know, other movements, and we've seen people in cross the line from faith to politics. Pat Robertson, you worked for George H.W. Bush. Pat Robertson challenged him, this may seem like a harsh word, but there's almost been the weaponization of faith in politics. If you share my points of view, you are a moral and decent person. If you don't, you're a heretic, and that I think, is the danger that you were speaking of.
That's exactly right. I agree with you. I mean, faith has informed some of the great social movements in American history, the abolition movement, the civil rights movement, and from my perspective, the pro-life movement and others. But it's a two-edged sword. In this country and within, obviously, the history of the world, you had the religious wars in the European continent that gave rise to John Locke and this concern about he and other Enlightenment philosophers who, having lived through that and seen what I think is fair appraisal, which is sometimes literally, sometimes figuratively, the weaponization of faith, what that can do. So, you know, history is complicated enough and human beings are complicated enough that you can pick and choose your historical examples to show when faith has been a source of healing and a source for decency, and when it's been a source of maliciousness and division. In this country, and really in sort of modern American politics, things really began to shift, I would say, in the 80s with Jerry Falwell Sr. and the Moral Majority, and Pat Robertson in the 80s, as you said. He challenged George H.W. Bush in 88. That was a movement that I think had some marginal good in some areas, maybe more than marginal good in other areas. But I think net, it was harmful, and I think it unleashed some dark forces within politics. And over that period of time, that sort of arc of modern American history from the 80s, 90s, 2000s to today, to see the way that faith has been employed has been, for me, a kind of painful experience as someone who was, up till now, I'd identified as an evangelical Christian. And I think part of it is that what I've seen is the subordination of faith to political tribalism and partisanship, and that's when it becomes weaponized. That's when it becomes a cudgel. It becomes a bat that you can beat people upside the head with, and also it's been interpreted and seen, and I think even delivered as censorious and judgmental. Often there is very little grace and redemption that is associated with faith and politics. Philip Yancey is a tremendous Christian author. He's sold, I think, 14 million books or so. Person I like and admire very much. And he did a book back in the 1990s called What's So Amazing About Grace. And in the course of that book, he would ask people, strangers, what they associated with the Christian faith. And he said what he kept hearing was political attachments to it. And he never once heard the word grace. And so if you're a person like I of that faith, where grace is so central to that faith, and that's being occluded, and not only occluded, people don't see that manifest, but they see something very different. I think today they see for a lot of Christians, not all by any means, I want to be fair to people who Christians who live their lives honorably. But for an awful lot, particularly prominent evangelical leaders, and I'm talking about people like Jerry Falwell Jr. and Franklin Graham and Eric Metaxas and Robert Jeffress and others, they speak with such a harsh spirit. And I think we've seen that there is, in their defense of Donald Trump, a kind of hypocrisy that is so obvious to everybody else, but apparently themselves. And so I think that has really had a discrediting effect on faith, and it bothers me a great deal. That's one of the reasons why I've spoken out as often, as vocally as I have, because I feel like something that I treasure and is important to me is being denigrated and harmed, and it's not only unnecessary, it's downright destructive.
That they would argue that there are trade-offs, right? I think Graham said, we I think it was Graham who said we're not electing the pastor in chief, but Trump has courted the evangelical community, or at least the leadership of the evangelical community, around what he would call religious freedom issues. Certainly on the issue of abortion. It feels it's hard for me to know where the sort of faith agenda, though, starts and ends, and a political agenda does. It's as if the whole thing has merged together, and there's kind of this arrangement to defend what is morally indefensible.
Yeah, that's an articulate way to put it. Let me deal with this, because it's a fascinating issue and it deserves to be disaggregated. You're quite right. And there is a responsible, I think, Christian evangelical case to make for having voted for Donald Trump. I didn't share it and I didn't vote for Donald Trump, but let me express it and then tell you where I think things have gone off the rails. That case would go something like this. Donald Trump, and it was an imperfect person for sure, morally imperfect, obviously. But on the issues that we care about, judges, courts, pro-life cause, a whole series of other issues, that these conservative evangelical Christians believe is better for the country, for the good of the country. Their argument was, you have to weigh these two things, and so a Trump presidency would do more good for more people than a Hillary Clinton presidency. And so, with reluctance, recognizing his moral failures and his drawbacks, we're going to vote for him. That's a reasonable position if you're a conservative evangelical Christian. Again, I disagree with it. Here's the problem with it, and I think there are several. Number one, we're no longer in a binary choice. The election is over. Hillary Clinton is not president. Donald Trump is. What's happened is that a lot of these prominent evangelical Christians have gone from making a prudential judgment to being the sword and shield for Donald Trump. They are his most reliable defenders. So they aren't capable, at least if they are, they haven't shown themselves capable of saying, look, we think the Gorsuch nomination was a good thing. But on the other hand, his treatment of women and his pathological lies and his denigration of the poor and his attacks are something that are really troubling and problematic. And hush money, $130,000 for a porn star, while your third wife was at home with your child. That really troubles us. They don't seem able to do that. They are like 100% in defense of him, to the point that Tony Perkins, who heads up the Family Research Council, when this issue came up about the payments, hush money for this porn star, said, well, we're going to give him a mulligan. And so that kind of corruption, that intellectual and I think a kind of moral intellectual corruption, is very problematic. Second thing is that I would say is that this is just complete hypocrisy. I'm old enough to remember the 1990s and Bill Clinton. And a lot of these guys were the same ones who were talking about the importance of moral character in leaders. That was primus inter pares. That was the most important thing of all. That mattered to them then. It doesn't matter to them now, and which leads one to think that this is about political tribalism. If it's a Democrat who's acted in morally questionable or problematic ways, then you go after them both barrels blazing. But if it's a Republican, you go sotto voce, or you defend him. And the third thing I'll say is that,
this is evident, by the way, also in the Roy Moore campaign.
Exactly. And Roy Moore's, after the Post story came out, where these were credible allegations of child molestation, evangelical support for Roy Moore went up in Alabama, according to the polls, which shows you just how sick this whole thing is.
You wrote a column after that saying why I can no longer call myself an evangelical Republican.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, I'm not less of a Christian or less of a conservative during the Trump era, but I'm very uncomfortable calling myself now a Republican, even though my roots are with the Republican Party. I have a lot of friends who are Republicans. And I think below the level of Donald Trump, there are certainly people like Ben Sasse and Senator Lee and others who I like and admire. But Donald Trump is the face of the Republican Party. And in terms of evangelical Christianity, I certainly haven't given up on my Christian faith. But that term has become so politicized and I think so denigrated because of that politicization that that it bothers me. And again, I want to underscore it. You know, evangelical Christianity, it's a huge movement. It's about a quarter of the country. There are people who in their daily lives are doing great good and great charitable work. And there are evangelicals who are uncomfortable with Trump. Some of them didn't vote for him. Some of them voted with him with reluctance. Having said that, time after time after time, by most of the metrics that we can measure these things, they just rallied to his side and his cause, and they did with Roy Moore. And something is deeply amiss. So, you know, I mean, it doesn't really matter that I don't call myself an evangelical Christian anymore, but it, you do what you feel like you have to at any given moment in time. And the Trump era was bad enough, and then to see what happened with Roy Moore, I was like, at some point, you just say enough.
It's not just the evangelical moniker, but the Republican Party itself has changed. And it strikes me, Pete, you worked for three presidents. You worked for both Bushes. You worked in the Reagan administration. You served at a very high level with George W. Bush. You were a policy, senior policy person in that White House. I know took great pride in PEPFAR and some of the work that President Bush did in Africa on the AIDS issue. But 90% of Republicans give their approval to this president now. How do you account for that? And where are the outraged voices within the Republican Party about things that are not consistent with traditional Republicanism and not consistent with kind of the moral standards that you've spoken about?
Yeah, let me take those in reverse order. Where are those voices? Well, they're not in Congress. That's for the most part.
Why?
I think they're not because I think there's a lack of courage. Go back to John Kennedy and Profiles in Courage.
Yeah, I always say it was a slim volume for a reason.
It was a slim volume for a reason. Look, Donald Trump tapped into the base of the Republican Party. As you said, he's now supported by 90% or so of Republicans, and there are just not enough Republicans in Congress, in the House, and the Senate, who are willing to go crosswise of him, because it would create an uprising. It might endanger their election chances. Some people, I think, make more prudential judgments, but I think in the end, wrong judgments. I think their argument, to be fair to them, would be, look, Trump was 18 out of 17 candidates. I wish he wasn't president, but we got to work with him. And if I fired off the rounds at Trump that you do rhetorically, I would have no influence with the Trump administration. And we've got to have somebody to try and keep the ship from...
Well, and also, there is the argument that he delivered tax cuts and deregulation, right, and the judges, as you mentioned earlier, and some of the traditional priorities of conservatives in Congress. So it's kind of a Faustian bargain. You get that,
right,
and you have to take the rest.
Yeah, and it's the rest that I think is so so deeply troubling, because politics is more than where you just check the policy boxes. And I say that as somebody who's, as you said, spent a lot of my life in public policy. I don't mean for a moment to diminish that importance, but that's not all of what politics is about, and it's not all of what the life of a country is about as it relates to politics. There are such things as norms and standards of decency, and respect for institutions. And when you have, just to take one issue, and then I'll go to your issue about how the Republican Party got into this bind. Let's take the issue of truth and lies. Let's grant that a lot of politicians shade the truth, some lie, and sometimes there are close calls, about where on the spectrum people, how forthcoming they are. So let's just grant that. There has never been a president who has been as pathological a liar as Donald Trump, who is engaged not just on an assault on truth, but the almost daily annihilation of truth, that has deep consequences for politics and for a country. We are, I think, in some respects, in a kind of post-truth moment in politics, which is a real threat to democracy. And the kind of assaults that Donald Trump is engaging in terms of our and most important institutions, whether it's the FBI or it's the courts or it's our intelligence agencies, these things matter. They used to matter a whole lot, by the way, to conservatives themselves. All right. You know, back in the 80s and 90s and even 2000s, it was conservatism that was actually making this argument against deconstructionism and postmodernism on the academy, said that objective truth matters. And now you've got it flipped around, and Donald Trump is leading this assault in the political sphere, and now which is I think seeping out into the civic sphere. And conservatives and Republicans are not only not stopping it, they're helping it. As for what happened to the Republican Party and how it nominated Trump and how it's turned out to be what it now is. That's a great question. It's a complicated one. I think several things went on. One is we've seen a tremendous devaluation of ideas, I think, within the conservative movement and the Republican Party. You know, Daniel Patrick Moynihan in 1981 wrote a piece in the New York Times where he said the GOP of a sudden had become the party of ideas. And when I was really a child of the Reagan era in the 1980s, what were the important books of that era? Charles Murray, Losing Ground, Richard John Newhouse, The Naked Public Square, James Q. Wilson and Richard Herrnstein, Crime and Human Nature, Alan Bloom and The Closing of the American Mind. Ideas were taken seriously. Antonin Scalia, Judicial Restraint. Whatever you think of Scalia's philosophy, he was brilliant and he was articulate in expressing it. That has now gone, and I think the politics of theatrics has taken over from the politics of governance. I think that Republicans and conservatives, for a lot of them, there's a denigration of government, an indifference to it. They don't much like it, and they're not much interested in it.
So a lot of people say, well, this has been going on for 40 years, that government was depicted by President Reagan as a malign force. Now, I remember Reagan making deals with Democrats, and I think it was a slightly different picture than it is depicted as now. But clearly, he had his was an assault on government isn't the solution to our problems. It is the problem. That was Reagan.
So yeah. Yes, it's a fair point, but I'd caveat it. Reagan was, I don't think, really reckless. Even if you go back to his inaugural, what he said was, at this moment, government is the problem, not the solution. And I think he had a fair point at that time in history, that government had become too large. And Reagan, in the way he treated government, and actually the way he executed government, had a certain respect for it. Trust in government went up during the Reagan years, not down, because it was viewed as things were going well. Of course, he won re-election with 49 states. So there is a critique of conservatism, and I would grant you that conservatives too often have been too reckless and loose in their criticisms of government. But I think in terms of their performance as government, I think that they did well. I would actually turn to another figure. I think Newt Gingrich was much more damaging in that assault on government, because I think his attacks on government were less modulated and less careful than Reagan's. I think Gingrich introduced a kind of nihilism, or at least a quasi-nihilism, and a personalization of politics that was very popular
Well, when you talk about the sort of dissolution of the legislative process, I mean, you really have to trace it back to the purging of his purging of Bob Michael and the Republican leadership. And I mean, he has a real instinct for exploiting these divisions and personalizing these fights, dehumanizing opponents.
That's right. If you go back, I think it was in the 1990s, maybe even earlier than that, where he would put forth a sort of certain vocabulary that the Republicans were supposed to use. So if I'm recalling it right, it would invoke the word, you know, corruption a lot. So but it was this whole view that it was and an attitude that the people that you disagree with aren't simply wrong. They're wicked, or they're out to destroy America. And it's not confined to the right. The left has had its version of it too. I think it's attacks on Robert Bork. Some of them really crossed the line, and I think hyper-politicized the court nominations in a way that prior to that, well, there were exceptions that wasn't there. The left has its own problems. I think part of the reason that I'm troubled so much by what's happening with conservatism and Republican Party, it's partly because I've been a conservative and a Republican my whole life. And I do think that here and now, the moment that we're at, it's really the Republican Party and the right, I won't even call it conservatives, that are probably doing the most damage to our political and civic culture. I don't think it's an accident, by the way, that Newt Gingrich now is one of the leading proponents and defenders of Donald Trump.
You talked earlier about the rapid evolution and societal changes. You mentioned gay rights as one of them. Isn't tolerance a virtue? I mean, shouldn't we be tolerant of each other and our differences? So I ask you that on the one hand. On the other, it seems to me, it feels to me right now like Trump is taking care of his donors with his tax cuts and some of his economic policies, with the sort of traditional kind of arrangements in Washington, and he is inflaming his support, his base, primarily around these cultural issues, immigration. He actually has an address. Gay marriage feels like it's an issue that has been asked and answered, but on abortion and some other issues, he seemed, well, the kneeling issue and so on. I mean, he seems to be feeding the base a steady diet of red meat around sort of cultural issues while taking care of the traditional special interests on economics.
Yeah, I think that's right. Let me take those in order in terms of tolerance being a virtue. Absolutely. And it was in the Enlightenment for so much of it's central to the political philosophy that informs democracy and a republic, which is tolerance for different views. That is how it works, right? Which is you have differences and you're able to tolerate those differences. Now, how that applies on the issue of, say gay marriage and so forth, sure, the advocates of same-sex marriage would say that this is a manifestation of a humane tolerance, and therefore you ought to be in favor of it. The critics of it would say that this is a time-honored institution, marriage, and that to change the definition would harm the institution of marriage. So they don't see it through the prism of tolerance. That's different than how you would.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think just in fairness to the supporters, they wouldn't just say that. They would say that everybody is entitled to the right to marry, whether they're gay or straight.
Right. No, they would make that, and their argument has certainly won the day. And by the way, it is interesting if you go back over the history of the same-sex marriage debate to show you in a way the power of ideas and how moments can change. There were really two people who made those arguments early on. That was Andrew Sullivan, who I mentioned earlier, and then Jonathan Rauch. And they made what was interesting to me is that they made their case in very careful and non-inflammatory ways. They went out of their way not to accuse their critics and those who had views different than them of being bigots, and they tried to answer their arguments one at a time. And they both did a very, very good job and at that. And public opinion shifted not just because of them, but I think in part because of them. My point simply on the tolerance is, I do think it's a virtue, and we probably all need need it more. But again, how you apply it on different matters. Some people will view particular public policy issues through the prism of tolerance. Others will say this isn't really a matter of tolerance. It has to do with, in this case, the strength of institutions. In any event, as it relates to Donald Trump, I think you're exactly right. And I want to illustrate what I think is the pernicious nature of his presidency. When he mentioned the NFL players and not kneeling for the national anthem, what had happened a few days before that was that he had made noises that were sympathetic on DACA for children who had come to the United States. Their parents were undocumented workers, and this was a debate that's going on now on whether those people should be deported or not. Most people overwhelmingly say they shouldn't. Trump himself had been somewhat sympathetic to it, and he was getting some criticism from talk radio world and others who are very, very, I think, harsh and rigid and on the issue of immigration and illegal immigration. So what did he do? He went down to Alabama on a Friday. It was a speech for Luther Strange during the primary in the Alabama Senate
against
race.
Roy Moore.
Against Roy Moore. And what did he do? He brought up the issue of NFL players not standing up, kneeling for the national anthem. The previous weekend, I think 6 or 7 players in the NFL had not stood for the national anthem. It was not an issue at that time. He went out of his way.
He inflamed it, yeah.
Exactly. And you've used that word a couple of times, and I think it's exactly the right one. I found myself using it a lot now, too, which is inflame, the inflammation of the body politic. And what Trump does is he finds these cultural flashpoints. And he knows his base, large parts of his base, well enough to know that if he gets into these cultural fights, not these policy fights per se, but cultural fights, fights about symbolic issues, but which have deep meaning to the country, that his supporters will forgive him transgressions of conservative orthodoxy or Republican orthodoxy as long as he's getting into these fights. And I think that there are fights that are dividing the nation and really zeroing in on some of the fault lines in American history and American society. And he seems to take great delight in rending the country and pulling it apart. No other president I can think of has done this. Other presidents have certainly been imperfect in terms of trying to unify the country. And it's not an easy task to do. Both the president I worked for and you tried to unify the country, and it became more polarized.
Most presidents see that as their responsibility.
Yeah, and it's a mixed bag. I mean, they know that they're the head of the party, and during elections they have to mobilize their supporters, and nobody is perfect, and so that's all true. But there's never been a president that I can think of, certainly in my lifetime, but I don't think really in American history, like Donald Trump, who has gone out of his way to intentionally divide us and divide us on grounds of race and ethnicity. And he does it, I think, both as a political strategy and as, I think, something that seems to be true to him and his personality. He seems to draw a kind of psychic energy and satisfaction at creating chaos and turmoil and division.
Well, it kind of sprung from the brow of the New York tabloids, too. He grew up in that environment in which he, if you stir the pot, you get at the reward of attention.
Right. But the problem here is that not simply that Trump is doing it, but that a large number of Republicans in his base is reacting to it. That is, Donald Trump knows his base.
Oh, yes.
And he knows what they'll react to. And that's, for me, been a difficult revelation because what I've seen during the Trump era, what it's revealed about the Republican Party and the American right is a side that I guess I knew existed, but I didn't have any idea was as widespread as it apparently is. It's not an accident that Donald Trump won the Republican nomination. Now, he won the presidency, too, and that's its own series of issues that went into that. But he is popular among the people on the right. And this is not a party anymore, the Republican Party, that cares primarily about economics. It's now a party that cares primarily about ethnicity and cultural identity. And that's where things, I think, are really getting ugly.
And just to close out the discussion, how does this story end?
I don't know how the story ends, and I don't think any of us do, because history is unfolding. I think it's important at this time, where there's a lot to be concerned about, to remember that history and politics isn't linear, and things can go in cycles. And sometimes viruses create their own antibodies. And it wouldn't surprise me that that the Trump political virus creates its own antibodies over time, and that people, having seen what Trump is doing to our political and civic culture, and just the sheer exhaustion of his presidency, will over time look for something different. I mean, you are know enough about history and politics. You're well versed in it to know that often certain political figures give rise to other figures, and movements give.
And he is an example of it. And frankly, I felt that Obama was well positioned to take advantage exactly. of the times in which he ran. I do think people search for the remedy, not the replica of what they have, even if when you have a popular president. So I think that that's true. But as you point out, these are extraordinary times. So we'll see if these historical models hold. I think the promise of democracy is that it's a self-correcting mechanism.
Yeah.
And I think it will be, but there are lots of questions to unfold here, including what the nature of the Republican Party will be moving forward.
I agree with that, and I do think that in the short term, things are going to get worse rather than better. I think we're going to have to buckle our seatbelts because Donald Trump is there. In the end, I feel like Donald Trump has to be repudiated, and Trumpism has to be repudiated for the country and the Republican Party to recover. But I also believe that whatever happens when Donald Trump leaves the scene, at whatever point that he does, that a lot of these currents and movements and dispositions and sentiments that exist on the American right aren't going to disappear. The question is, in part, is there a figure or figures who can rise up and channel the discontent and the grievances in a way that's constructive and humane? And productive. Right now, that's not happening, and you've got these feelings, these deep grievances that a lot of people on the American right feel. And with that in place, you've got a president who is let's say that that's the kindling, and then he takes the blowtorch.
I think just on the way out the door here, I'll say something that will be provocative and will undoubtedly. Engender some response, but I think that one of the things that is inflaming the base is a sense that history is moving in a way that they're uncomfortable with. History is going to continue to move, and so I don't know that the base is going to become more quiescent, but it may become less relevant.
I think that's a fair point. I think for a lot of people, and you know, if you talk to Trump supporters, one of the things I do believe that we have to do is to learn to listen well to people who have differences. And in my case, that means listening to Trump supporters and to try and hear where they're coming from, mm-hmm. and to try and honor people's own experiences and not to dehumanize them in the process. It's very easy. To do. So I do believe that for reasons that are complicated, some that are malicious, some that certainly are not, for a lot of Trump supporters, there is a sense that things are going awfully fast and the country that they knew is changing. And for a lot of them, culturally, some of it is ethnicity and demography.
Some of it is economics.
Some of it is economics. It's a complicated mix. And I think the net effect of that is an effort to try and, as Bill Buckley said years ago in the National Review, stand athwart history and say stop. But you can't stop history. And there are certain movements that you can't stop. But again, I think what you have to do, and I think what conservatives traditionally have done when conservatism is at its best, is to recognize these changes and to channel them in constructive and humane ways and to become the party and the agents of reform. So it's not simply saying stop to history, but trying to recognize what's going on, to prudentially see what the dangers are, to try and set up guardrails. and to act in ways that makes us better than we were, and that unifies the country. And right now we're not there.
Yes, it's hard to see our way from here to there, but you're a person of faith, and we share a secular faith in democracy, and we shall see where it leads. Pete Wehner, it's always good to be with you. Thank you. Thank you for being here at the Institute of Politics.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for for having me on the show and for hosting me.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.